All right. I am ready, so let's go ahead and open up with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for waking us up this morning. We thank you for this day that you've set apart for us to worship 1 out of 6. We do pray that we would put aside all of those things that have detained us, that bother us, that have even our lawful callings. We pray that we'd lay those aside and we would wholly fix upon spiritual and heavenly things. As we discuss a piece of history this morning, we pray that you'd give us great wisdom, that we would be wise in how we think about history and the things that you have been doing and the things that you continue to do. We ask now that you bless our time together. In Jesus' name, amen. So I did volunteer for this lesson. So this was not imposed upon me. When I taught on Islam, it was not really imposed. I agreed to do it, but it wasn't a subject of which I was super familiar with. The Crusades I know a little bit more about, and I hope to, in the space of about 45 minutes or less, talk about, 450 years of history, so we're going to do our best. So it is a difficult challenge. So I've entitled this, as you see at the top, Has God Willed It? This was a common phrase used during that God wills it to go on crusade. And what I want to do this morning is talk a little bit about the Crusades, and I will explain in, basically, I've got larger introduction section for reasons you'll see shortly. Let me just start with the sources, which you see on your second page. There are a number of sources. I've relied primarily on Thomas Madden, who himself, in his bibliography, I would recommend this book if you're interested in reading a concise, shorter history of the Crusades. I'd recommend Madden's book. He has 67 recommended historical sources in his own bibliography. And I got all three of these books are available through Athens-Clarke County Library System, so they were very easy to get a hold of. Madden, by the way, for reference, is the professor of history and director of the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at St. Louis, and he's an expert in this area. He wrote specifically a book with another author on the Fourth Crusade in particular, but he is a historian. Now, in terms of the Crusades today, contemporary views of the Crusades typically swing towards two extremes. One is extreme disdain that the Crusades were kind of a continuation, or at least our colonial acts that came later for the West. So they would view that as a type of colonialism, so it's hatred, and especially the outward expressions of religion. Or you often have uncritical approval of the Crusades as if they were an unmitigated good with no downside to them at all. And the fact is that prior to 9/11, which some of you weren't even born in 2001, prior to 9/11, the Crusades were really not known to many people outside of certain special interest groups that had an interest in knowing them. Prior to 9/11, there was nothing known. So I'm going to read a quote from, this is from Madden's introduction, or his preface to his book. Scholars know much more about the Crusades today than ever before. However, most of that research is highly technical in nature and presented, appropriately enough, in scholarly journals and monographs that can seem impenetrable to those without specialized training. When the first volume of this book was published, and that's in 1999, it joined only two other single-volume histories of the Crusades written by professional historians, and even those two assumed a fair level of knowledge regarding medieval history. Back then, an interested person who simply strolled into a bookstore looking for a history of the Crusades was more likely to walk out with a book by a novelist, a journalist, or an ex-nun than one written by care by a scholar based on the best research available. The heightened public interest in the Crusades after 9/11 created a strong market for new general histories, and popular authors did not disappoint. Yet many of those new works simply retold myths long dispelled by professional historians. And he goes on to say that the number of books, he said the trickle became a torrent, and they probably ran out of creative ideas to call their books because there were so many books available in the Crusade. So he goes on to say that clearly there was a lot of going on, but he said, yet despite the avalanche of new studies, the fundamental purpose of this book, speaking of Madden's book, has not changed since 1999. It aims to tell the story of the Crusades in a concise, understandable, and engaging manner based on the extraordinary fruits of more than half a century of modern scholarship. And I would agree with that. That was a very helpful book to me. I've read it, listened to it several times. It's been very informative for me. And, of course, his other sources he mentions. Another point of interest is that the first Arabic language history of the Crusades was not written until 1899. So this is not something that is in the Islamic cultural thought really until the 20th century, for maybe what might be obvious reasons. But the most obvious reason is that from the West, from their perspective, the Crusades were a failure. And so they just looked at it as another instance of somebody trying to take over the impenetrable and indomitable Islamic religion, which, of course, they have no cultural memory of this whatsoever. It's just like, it was a failed thing. The other thing I would point out to you is that one of the most probably well-known Muslim characters during the Crusades was during the Third Crusades, a man named Saladin, was actually a Kurd. And so he had no social standing whatsoever amongst Arabs in general, because the Kurds get zero social respect compared to, say, Arabians. If it had been an Arabian man, it might have been different. But he was not. And so the cultural memory amongst the Muslims has only been stirred up in the last 100 years, which ironically coincides with a lot of Western involvement in the Middle East. So those are the sources, to talk a little bit about sources. In terms of historiography, my next point here in the introduction, my motivation this morning is really to explain how the Crusaders saw themselves at the time, not how we would imagine them to be. The Crusaders technically were not soldiers. They were pilgrims. Wearing of the cross, the taking on the cross, which is what that Latin phrase at the top of your page there on the title, the wearing of the cross actually meant that the wearer became a temporary ecclesiastic and subject to church courts. They could be subject to the church courts in ways that normal, regular Christians were not. They became kind of a de facto clergy by taking on the cross. And it was an act of significant religious significance. Okay? Most of them were extremely poor. They risked literally everything, and many lost everything. Even noblemen did. And so, but they did so as expressions of faith and piety. And so they did not go in the warring mindset. They did go with war in mind, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute. But they went in mind as a religious exercise. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that they were all necessarily biblically pious, but they did do so. At least they, what they were thinking they were doing is sincere expressions of piety and faith. You will notice at the top of your page my theme verse, Matthew 16:24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." This was preached by medieval preachers in support of the Crusades. Now, if someone preached a crusade today based on this text, we would probably be like, that's probably not the right interpretation. Okay? To put it mildly. Yeah. They also preached on Matthew 19:29, "Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life." And so this was an expression of faith and piety from their perspective. So this is the motivation. They are pilgrims. They are going on pilgrimage, and they are going to use violence to accomplish their end. We'll talk more about that here in just a moment. So the reason this is very difficult for moderns is because we have so compartmentalized religion. We have so public expressions of religion now are verboten. They were not really acceptable before, even less so now. And so this you understand why there's so much hostility in some respects toward the Crusades, because these public expressions, which were very commonplace at the time, just are not acceptable, even amongst Roman Catholics. So, I mean, Christians in general don't express themselves this way. This is why the Crusades, you don't see this kind of, you know, publicizing and look at this great thing that we did. They don't look at it that way for these reasons. All right. Last point I want to make about historiography is the narrow focus. It's hard for us to understand this, but the Crusading period, if we take the whole Crusading period, is actually almost 1,000 years. There was a steady stream of pilgrims moving both into the Iberian Peninsula, which is Spain now, and to the Middle East. There was crusading to the north. There were all kind of crusades going on, literally for almost 1,000 years, roughly between the 8th century all the way up to the very end of the 17th century. So this huge amount of time. Clearly, we can't cover all of that today. Most of the crusading that people think about is typically in the middle, what we call now the Middle East. And so that's where we're going to put our primary focus. I'll mention some of these other crusades later in some of the other background. But just for the time being, I just want you to know we're going to primarily focus on that narrow section. Now, methodology. I know this is a long introduction, but you'll see why here, I hope, in just a minute. I'm not going to be able to spend a lot of time on the Crusades themselves. They're very complex. A lot of different things were going on. I'm going to try to summarize in my very fast way of talking as much as I can. But I want to talk more about why certain things happen. I hope that all of you appreciate the fact that when we talk about historical events happening, they don't happen in a vacuum. It's not like suddenly just something happens. There's usually a long train of events that have led up to these things. That's really what I want to talk about, because there's cultural background, there's religious background, there's all sorts of things going on to say, and then suddenly this happened. Well, okay, that's probably not true. Now, you could go back, too far, try to explain everything, we'll just say. But I think some context is really important to help us talk about this. And so our time in this 45-minute period or so, or hour or so, less now, we'll be talking about more about the historical and ecclesiastical context and the motivations of those involved to the degree that we can know this with any certainty. So before I go any further, are any questions or comments on this? Yes, sir.
I had a question. You're talking about crusading more generally. Is this essentially a missionary endeavor, sort of the Christianizing?
Not really, but we'll get into some of the details here in just a minute.
Okay.
Yes. So, yeah. So I've got hopefully on your outline, should be on the first page, a historical kind of timeline. And these are obviously selective because I'm not going to be able to cover every year, and not every year something was happening. But this is for my purposes to kind of put the context of crusading in general. So in 637, Jerusalem is captured by the Rashidun, if anyone doesn't remember. That is the second caliphate of the Islamic Empire. And Jerusalem is captured. Now, this is a result. I didn't put this on here. This is really a result of the Battle of Nineveh, which was in 627. There won't be a test by the way, later on this. 627, the Battle of Nineveh, is basically where Persia, the Persian Empire, the Sassanids, were defeated by Byzantium, which is the Eastern Roman Empire. The Persians were extremely weak. 10 years later, they were taken over by Islam. And so they had no way to defend themselves. They were so exhausted by this battle. And they were able to move right in. The Rashidun Caliphate was able to move right in. Christians and Jews living there, of which there were a good number, became what they call dhimmi, or protected class. They have to pay a tax. They have to acknowledge Muslim rule. They're free to practice their religion. And they remain mostly unmolested. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that in war nobody dies. That would be a lie. Okay? But after the dust settled, they did have their own communities, their own places to live. They were able and free to practice their own religion on their own terms. And it was generally, they just didn't do anything with them for the most part, because it was a nice source of revenue for them. Okay? Now, the next marker I have on here for you is in 732, the Battle of Tours, which we've talked about some of this. Charles, anyone remember his name?
Charles the Hammer.
That's right. Charles Martel, the Hammer, pushes Muslim forces out of Frankish territory into Spain, or at the time it was the Iberian Peninsula. I don't know what they called it at the time. So Spain was also considered Christendom. So at this time, or actually just before this time, what's called the Reconquista, which is its own history, and I've done some homework on this as well. We're not going to be able to talk about it because that's its own thing, to recapture what to them were consecrated Christian lands. That got underway in 722 as a result of the 711 Umayyad invasion, which was the third wave of the Islam that came in there. But the reason this is important is because the Iberian Peninsula became a training ground, the theological and moral justification for the crusading movement as a whole, which would include both pilgrimage and military campaign. Now, what the Reconquista did not do, until this didn't happen until later, did not articulate what spiritual benefits would come to participants, though the church did promote holy war as a just and appropriate response to Muslim aggression. And so this was the training ground. Now, you'll notice the years on here because, well, we'll talk about that here in a minute when we get to the end. Now, I'm skipping up to 1037, not to say that nothing was happening, but in terms of our context, this is now where the game begins to change. And the Seljuk Empire comes in, and they are established. They are a Turkic people who pretty much take over the Persian rulers, and they start moving westward through Anatolia towards Byzantium. Now, if you don't know where Anatolia is, think about Turkey. Okay, so they come in this direction they're moving west. They're moving right towards Byzantium. They basically took over that empire. Now, the Seljuks, think about them as very young. They were relatively recent converts to Islam, super fundamentalist and super excited about their new faith. Imagine their shock when they show up in Jerusalem and they're like, what are all these Christian churches and monasteries? What are they doing here? And they started wholesale slaughtering them. What are these people doing here? And they captured pilgrims. They murdered clergy. It was not a good few years. However, what they discovered pretty quickly is that Jerusalem as a city was pretty much worthless without Christian tourism and pilgrimage. The city had no commercial value whatsoever, and they figured that out really quickly, and so they stopped the official persecution. After about 2 or 3 years, they just simply said, now, the official persecution stopped, but that doesn't mean that other local lesser magistrates didn't take action, very much like in the Roman Empire, where you have times of official persecution, and then you have times of unofficial, like, well, we're not officially condoning this, but we're also kind of turning a blind eye. This happens, by the way, in a lot of places like India and other places where you don't see decided government action against Christians, but they have inaction against violence against Christians. So the same kind of thing is happening here. Okay? So Jerusalem is extremely profitable because of the vast sums of money of people coming in eager to pray at all these various holy shrines. And I'm using this in air quotes, so we're going to take this at face value for what it was for them. We'll talk about this a little bit later. But pilgrimage to the Holy Land at that time, during this time period, became much more difficult than it had been. The Arabs were like, we'll take your money. And the Seljuks were like, I guess we'll take your money after we made the mistake of slaughtering a bunch of people. So 1054 is the Great Schism. This is where the Greek and the Latin churches basically excommunicate each other, which I think we've got this a little out of order. So I would apologize to you, but Taylor will have to apologize to you until next week. So we're going to go back and talk about the Great Schism next time. But this happens, and this is context, though, because a few years later that, the Battle of Manzikert in 1071 is where the Byzantine army was completely destroyed, and the emperor, the first time this had ever happened, was actually captured by the Turks, by the Seljuk Empire. Okay, so he was the sultan. He actually didn't want to fight the emperor when he found out the emperor was there. It's actually a really interesting story. He was very enamored of the emperor, and he made the emperor lay down, and he put his foot on his head, and he said, okay, you can get up now. And I just want ransom money. And they let him go back. And then, unfortunately, the emperor was subject to a conspiracy in his own household, and they blinded him and put him out, and he ended up dying from his wounds. So the emperor did better under them than he did under his own family. Now, the next, I have we're not sure exactly when Pope Gregory VII, during 1072 to 75. The reason I put that window there is because we don't exactly know when. I know it's after the Battle of Manzikert and before the start of the investiture controversy. But basically, the Pope reaches out to the emperor attempting to repair relations and to help these Eastern Christians that have been suffering under Seljuk rule. And so he offers to help them. However, he was interrupted in 1076 by the investiture controversy. He said, I have more things going on. I don't have time to give context for this. 1076, start of investiture controversy. This is really about who can appoint church officers, and there's all sorts of things going on here. Gregory's terribly distracted, and so he says, I got other things to worry about. Fast forward 20 years later, the emperor, the Byzantine emperor, Alexios, sends ambassadors to Piacenza asking for Western military help. This is in the spring. Now, in the help of retaking what were Byzantine lands, so this gets back to Pastor Monahan's question a minute ago. What was the motivation? The motivation was basically that they said our lands are being taken. Now, the further context of this is that the Byzantium Empire thought of Western Europe as their own land, temporarily being squatted on by a bunch of German barbarians. Now, this was a very ironic and somewhat humbling thing for him to say, can you come help us? Pastor Taylor was telling us a couple times ago, if you remember when Charlemagne offered to marry the emperor's daughter, and they were kind of like, no. It was just like some provincial yokel.
Yeah.
You know, we look at Charlemagne, and he is a great man.
Yeah.
But they were like, some German king?
You can't even read Greek?
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. So, the Byzantines had long viewed Western Europe as rightly belonging to them, temporarily occupied by these barbarians. And while they regarded them as Christians, they considered them, now get this, misguided by their liturgical errors and heretical beliefs, chief of which was their insistence on the central authority of the Pope over all Christians. So this was a central dividing line. Who really has authority? If you look through this timeline, what you will see is in the East, who's speaking to the West? It's the emperors. Who's speaking in the West to the East? It's the Pope. So this is why you see that the papacy is going to be slowly increasing in power and influence, because there was no single ruler the way that there was in the Eastern Empire. This is a reflection of the old Roman Empire. This is the old Roman Empire. All right, later in the fall, the Council of Clermont, Pope Urban II calls for arms in defense of Christian peoples and lands in the East. And so there were other things decided at this council, but this was the big mile marker. We actually, believe it or not, don't even have the original text. We have like four or five different accounts of the text, but we don't really know what he said, but we get the general gist based on what happened after that. Now, to conclude off this section for historical context, I want to be careful how I say this, but I think it's really important to know that while the motivations of the West to defend Christians in the East is true, keep in mind that 450 years have passed since Jerusalem was taken. 450 years. Think back 450 years in our own history. Oh, do we even have that part of history? I guess we go to Jamestown and kind of get there. But my point being is that this is a long period of time. Why so much inaction? Why had not the East? I mean, there's obviously this is why this era of history is so complex. So to simply say it was like, we're going to retake Christian lands, it's like, where were you guys years ago? There's reasons for that. There's obviously reasons for that. Now, any questions on the historical background here? Yes, sir.
I'll just add one quick note. After 1071, when the Emperor Romanus IV was captured by the Turks, basically the Byzantine Empire had a civil war for the next 10 to 15 years.
They did.
They were so weakened, they couldn't even help protect the pilgrims in the Middle East.
Yep. So that's good. Thank you, Bob. So, all right, ecclesiastical and theological background. So let's talk about this very briefly, because I'm already 5 minutes behind what I expected my schedule to be. So we're just going to have to plow through some of this. All right, so the first point of this background is just war theory. Now, this is via Augustine, not Aquinas. Now, just war theory in the Christian tradition would be modified over the years. Via Augustine, this is where this comes from, because he would have been the last great at this time. So first off, you have a right intention in the participants, expressed by love of God and love of neighbor. So to have a just war, you have to have a right intent. Your heart has to be right. We would agree with this. This is good. The second is fought for a just cause. We would also agree with this. This is good. It also has to have a legitimate proclamation by a qualified and or lawful authority. At the time, the Pope would have been a lawful authority. So we would say we're still tracking with you so far. Now, here's where it gets problematic. Well, not this point, but my next point. So the next one, there's kind of an addendum to this, is that violence is not intrinsically evil. Sometimes violence is necessary to do the good. And I think from a self-defense standpoint, we would understand that. We don't want to employ violence, but violence by itself, taken by itself, is not evil. Sometimes I have to defend and use violence to defend myself or my family or others. Sometimes that's necessary to do that. However, here's where we're going to begin to go off the rails, because the other addendum is that they basically were teaching, and this is kind of a complex, it's not really super complex, but they believed that Christ's wishes for mankind were associated with specific consecrated lands, i.e., that the Holy Land was Christ's royal domain. And by having it under Muslim occupation, that was obviously bad. And so they believed that Christ himself personally authorized the Crusades through his vicar, the Pope. Okay? This is why they said God wills it. Because the Pope, speaking on behalf of Christ, is saying, I want you to go do this. Now, I see some heads nodding in here. You kind of understand now, we get some context. It's not just like Christian lands have been overtaken. They believe they were consecrated, holy lands that would have been overtaken. Now, in addition to this, the next thing that will just ties right in here is holy pilgrimage, specifically to shrines and specifically to the Holy Land. These were encouraged as a mark of piety, good works, and became even meritorious. So traveling to the Holy Land would actually earn you something, would get credit, as it were, in terms of your faith. Okay? Now this leads, let me interrupt myself really quickly on this point. Traveling to see places like this is not fundamentally sinful. I was in Scotland a few years on my way back from somewhere else in business and had made arrangements to worship there on Sunday in Scotland, and they took me to Rutherford's grave. I got to stand on the spot where Patrick Hamilton, who was the first Reformation martyr in Scotland to be martyred, there's a spot, they marked it, and I got pictures of it. It was great. But I didn't go there because of good works. I went there because of my historical interest, and it was fascinating to see the old St. Andrews and the three walls that are left and all of that. But that was not pilgrimage. You can go to Geneva, you can go to see all of these things, and that's fine. We're not doing it for meritorious reasons. We're not doing it because we're earning something. There's nothing more holy about those places. As a historian, I take great interest in those kind of places, and you probably should too. This is part of our heritage and tradition. But that's not why they were going. That's my point. That's not why they were going. They were going as an act of piety, saying, part of my faith is expressed in doing this. Nobody is requiring you to go on a holy pilgrimage. And if anybody tells you, well, you better talk to your elders, but you're not doing that, right? We're not doing that. When you go on a trip of Northern Europe to see these Reformation places, you're not going on pilgrimage. That's not what they were doing. Now, the last thing I will add here, by way of introduction, or by way of background, I should say, is the sacrament of penance, which is one of the seven Roman Catholic sacraments. Okay, so this is one of the sacraments of the Church, still is today. It's at the Council of Clermont that Urban issued the first indulgence for those going on crusade who confess their sins in penance, meaning that he did tie it to their piety. So going on crusading, going as a pilgrim, was, in some respects, meritorious. Now, I hope you see from this very brief background that I've given you why we cannot simply adopt the Crusades as a wholesale, as a model today. I'll get to more of this in the conclusions. Not for the results. The results are what they are. We'll talk about that here in just a minute, the details. The results are what they are. But we have to understand the background of how they saw themselves, why they were going, and what motivated them to go. And you see, I hope you see, there's some problems there if we're going to import this into the modern age. This is not easy to do. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, historians like Thomas Madden have argued strongly against politicizing the Crusades in the modern context. When 9/11 came out, they're like, we're going on a crusade. And historians like Madden and others have said, you don't understand the Crusades. Yeah. We are not on Holy Crusade here. Right. That is not what's going on. And so we need to be really cognizant of this as well. All right. Wow, I'm only 7 minutes behind where I thought I was going to be. I have a little note on where I wanted to be, so I'm happy. Any questions or comments up to this point? Oh, it's not that good, y'all. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the Crusades themselves. Now, the Crusades, for our purposes, and really, they're broken into numbers by historians because there was a steady stream of pilgrims moving from west to east for literally hundreds of years. So this is going on. So when we talk about the First Crusade, it's not like somebody marked off and said, okay, time marker, we're done. The World War I and II eras are really one big block of time with a 20-year interruption. I mean, you really, I mean, this is one big block of time. So the point is that there's still stuff going on that's leading. World War II just didn't fall out of a vacuum. That's not a subject we're going to talk about today. But same thing for here, right? All of these crusades, when we block them off in the time, there's clearly things that are happening during these at certain points that help us to mark them, but they are broken into numbers by historians, obviously not by the participants themselves. So the first crusading period is really roughly between 1095 and 1144. You will see different dates on some of these, but generally speaking, this is the first crusade period. And this one is divided really into two separate elements. The first is the People's Crusade, and the second is the Prince's Crusade. So let's talk about the People's Crusade first. In an effort to make this move a little bit faster, because I want to talk about the Fourth Crusade a little bit longer, I'm just going to read what I have here rather than speak up to you, so I apologize for those of you who are looking, want to see my face, or maybe you don't. In response to Urban's speech, that is, at the Council of Clermont, Peter the Hermit started preaching to the masses, who responded in a largely unorganized mass and started making their way across Europe, creating other problems in Hungary and Bulgaria. Okay. By the way, if you don't think what those might be, you have to feed people and you have to house people, and it ended up becoming not good as you have this mass of people that are completely motivated by the Pope's speech to say, go crusade, and say, okay, God wills it. He's going to take care of us along the way. And that's basically what they did, but not always in a lawful way. So they finally arrive in the region of Constantinople, and Alexios was very happy to see them and said, wait until the princes get here. He knew that there were others coming. They were organized themselves in the military. And they're like, no, that would be cowardly, and it wouldn't prove that it would prove that God is not with us, so we're going. And so they became unruly there in the neighborhood of Constantinople, and the emperor's like, you know what, I'm just going to put you on the ship and send you across the Bosphorus, and you're welcome to go over there. And that's what he did. They had some nominally limited success against the Turks and raided some villages, and there were different groups. And, again, there's a longer, complicated history here. Once the Seljuks figured out what was going on, they pretty much slaughtered them. The entire People's Crusade was completely wiped out. The only one that survived was Peter the Hermit, who was back in Constantinople trying to get additional help. So that crusade ended up being an utter and abject failure. Now, the Prince's Crusade was a little bit different. That was marked by multiple kingdoms involved, what we would call France, England, Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, even the Byzantium participated. The emperor made all of the prominent men swear oaths that they would give back the land that they captured and give it to him. It's his land. Yeah. So he made them swear an oath. They were not super happy with that. Now, remember the East-West differences already, okay? So now you have men who've mounted a campaign, they've mounted a crusade, they've mounted essentially a pilgrimage. It's not just a military campaign. It does involve military aspects of it. But they're like, well, so how are we going to get paid? We still have to get reimbursed here, okay? So unfortunately, they did reluctantly agree, but not without some hostilities, including at several points Constantinople cutting off their supplies, saying, you will sign this agreement that you're giving back land. And a little bit of conflict there. The Crusaders actually attacked Constantinople briefly, but the city at the time was one of the most impenetrable cities in the world. And so they were not successful there. But as a result, it created some bad blood between the East and the West, between the commanders of the West and the Byzantines. Okay, now, there's an incident that we can't talk about, but on crusade, as they're going marching, they're marching towards an Antioch, Alexios, basically the Byzantine Empire, the emperor, abandoned them and left them there. Well, at that point, they repudiated their oaths. They said he was a coward. And there's a complicated story there. Bottom line is, in 1099, Jerusalem was finally taken by the Western rulers. And it's actually a great story that they were able to actually take Jerusalem. Part of that was because the Seljuks had no idea what was going on, and so they were very disorganized, and so it was natural that they might lose this first battle. And so they retook Jerusalem, and then the really hot topic became, okay, who's going to govern this place? What do we do now? We came here to conquer. We came here to retake this land. Now what? And it became a hot topic amongst them about whether the Patriarch of Jerusalem would, that's an Eastern church member, the Patriarch, a papal legate from the West, Would it be a secular, quote-unquote secular king? Who is going to rule? And this ended up being a conversation that took place over a while. Finally, Baldwin, who was a Norman, was crowned king on Christmas Day in 1100. I didn't know if there was any direct connection with that and with Charlemagne or not, but that's a very interesting coincidence in some respects. But the kingdom of Jerusalem was proclaimed. He became king on 1100. So, again, this crusade doesn't typically end until 1144, and so you've got a lot more history here. There's a lot more, and I'm going to summarize this as best I can. You've got a lot more infighting between Christians and Christians, East and West. West and West are vying for power. You've got the Christians and the Muslims fighting one another. But eventually, what it ended up happening is this was the establishment of four feudal fiefs. Basically, the Kingdom of Jerusalem was established, the County of Tripoli, the County of Edessa, and the Principality of Antioch. The Muslims were extremely divided on this. They didn't know what to do, which is one of the reasons that they lost. They didn't understand the Crusaders. Even after the feasts were there, they lived side by side with them in these various different kingdoms. And so there was actually a lot of cultural interplay between Christians and Muslims, but very little intellectual or religious connection at all. Now, the reason I bring this up is because there wasn't constant warfare between Muslims and Christians, contrary to popular belief. It wasn't a steady stream of 100 years of war, or 50 years of war. I want to read something to you, which is really interesting to me, and I think it would be interesting to you as well. By the way, the Christians, the new rulers of Kingdom Jerusalem, all these things, viewed the Muslims as their neighbor, and they said, well, we've got to get along with them to some degree, so how do we best do that? Actually, there's some accounts that Madden points out, too, where a lot of the Muslim, contemporary Muslims were like, yeah, the new Christians that are coming over are really rude. But the older Christians have been here, they're actually decent guys. They understand us. So it's actually really interesting. But this is what a Christian, now this is a Christian contemporary observer said of the time. I pray you consider and reflect on how God has, in our times, changed West into East. For we, who were Occidentals, have now become Orientals. The man who was a Roman or a Frank has, in this land, been turned into a Galatian or a Palestinian. He who was once a citizen of Rheims or Carthage has now become a citizen of Tyre or Antioch. We have already forgotten the places where we were born. Many of us either do not know them or have never heard of them. One among us now has houses and retainers, just as if he possessed them through hereditary or family right. Another man takes as his wife not a woman of his own stock, but rather a Syrian, or an Arminian, or even, occasionally, a Saracen who has obtained the grace of baptism. Men address one another in the turn of speech in the idiom of various languages. The several languages of various nations are common here, and one joins faith with men whose forefathers were strangers. For it is written, the lion and the ox shall each draw side by side. And so the men from the West had begun to be changed by living in the East. And so they were becoming genuinely what we call the Latin East. Okay? And so they're not Eastern, they're not Byzantium, but they're not really Latin either. And so they became this kind of new thing. Remember, this is a pretty long time period. So I thought that was really fascinating. Now, during this time period, to kind of summarize the First Crusade here, during this time period, the military orders were created. Most notably, the Knights Hospitaller, the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, the Knights Templar, the Order of St. Lazarus, and then later, in 1192, you'll see the Teutonic Knights. But all of these military orders, so instead of just monastic praying, thinking, reading, scriptoriums, that sort of thing, these guys are, the Hospitallers, for example, were there to take care of pilgrims. So pilgrims who got sick, who got injured, they created one of the first hospitals. That's what their ministry was there for people coming to the Middle East in these kingdoms. And so the steady stream, they were obviously trying to free things up so that these pilgrims could continue to come. All right, I've not done justice to the First Crusade, and I'm not going to do justice to any of them. I already told you that I wasn't going to be able to because of the amount of detail. If there's no questions or comments, I'm going to move on to the Second Crusade.
The military orders were subject to the Pope.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the Pope had authorized to create them. Thank you, Cameron. The Pope had authorized to create these orders, and later they were disbanded. The last one was disbanded, I think, by Napoleon, if I'm not mistaken. Napoleon finally said, you're done, on his own authority. Yes. I guess when you're Napoleon, you do have that kind of authority. But anyway. Oh, yes, sir.
Question. Is there a writing regarding millennialism that's, I mean, the timing seems very, very interesting.
There was, yes. So Pastor Monahan's question was about millennialism. And yes, there was early on some talk about maybe we're at the end times. Maybe this 1,000 years is up and maybe that we're seeing. So there was some millennial, there was some of that aspect in there. It's a little bit of what we would call eschatology, especially tied to the Holy Land. Again, it's really tied to this kind of sacralized land, which, I mean, these ideas are still with us today, but they're not as prominent as they were. So, but then again, maybe not. So anyway, we'll keep going. Anything that, okay. Second Crusade period, a little bit shorter time period, 1145 to 1149. Remember, you have the steady stream. This was prompted by the fall of Edessa. Now, remember, you do have fighting. It's not constant warfare in every single place and every single time. Typically, battles are fought like over here, and here's the village. It's not like complete invasion in the same way. You do have that, but it's not that way. So the fall of Edessa is in November of 1144. Basically, what this did is this pitted the Christian kings against one another, including the Byzantines versus the Latins. Now, Bernard of Clairvaux was very instrumental in kicking off this particular crusade. And so a papal bull later authorized crusades every direction. So they went to the north, up to the Vendish territories. They went to the to Spain. They went everywhere. So this crusade is not just the one thing. That's why the Second Crusading period is very, very large. But the end result, in short, just to kind of shortcut this, was more division. The East and the West didn't like each other even more. They liked each other even less, we should say. And it was a failure in that it did not recover Edessa. It failed to take Damascus. And all of those divisions amongst the Christians actually strengthened and encouraged the Muslims. So they began to get their act together. So the Second Crusade was also a failure. In fact, Bernard of Clairvaux had to apologize to the Pope and say, forgive me for even talking about this. So Bernard's involvement actually did involve his repenting of mounting what ended up being a colossal failure as a military endeavor. The Third Crusade period, 1189 to 1192, regardless of its short time period, is actually the one that we most associate with crusading. This is the high peak. This is the high point in some respects of the crusading era, prompted primarily by Saladin's taking of Jerusalem in 1187. So Saladin was actually respected by the kings in that area. They considered him a gentleman. They played by the same rules. They treated him in the same way. He was an enemy to be respected. They didn't treat him. They treated him like equals would on the battlefield. So they didn't treat him badly. They didn't think badly of him. They said, he's a man of his word. We want to be men of our word. And so they're going to do this gentlemanly battle. Sounds like a very noble concept. But he had taken Jerusalem and conquered most of the Latin territory. So by the 1189, when the crusading period started, only Tripoli, Antioch, and Tyre remained in Christian lands. Basically, Saladin's army more or less crushed the Christians almost out of existence in terms of their influence. Okay, so in 1187, Pope Gregory VIII issued a papal bull. Now, here's why they didn't go. All of the European Western kingdoms were fighting each other for territory. And so Gregory said, all right, he issued a bull and say, y'all will stop fighting. He didn't say y'all. But if he was Southern, he would have said, y'all need to stop fighting. And that's basically what he did. He issued a papal bull and said, stop fighting. And they basically had to stop fighting. Oh, we got to take off this war so we can go to the Middle East. You need to focus on Christ's lands, not on your own. That was basically the argument. Okay? So he issued a papal bull imposing a 7-year peace on all these warring kingdoms so they could focus on retaking the Holy Land. Now, ironically, Gregory died only after 57 days in office, so that was really his only act as pope, was to get them to stop fighting with each other so they could go to Israel, to the Holy Land. Now, the primary characters in the Third Crusade, again, I'm running quickly out of time, are Richard the Lionheart, Philip II of France, Frederick Barbarossa, who ended up drowning on his way to crusade. That's an interesting story all by itself, and of course, Saladin, which we've already talked about. Though the Crusaders failed to take back Jerusalem, it is generally regarded as a success in that the Muslim military influence was significantly diminished and the Crusader kingdoms were at peace with one another. So generally regarded as success, even though they were not able to retake Jerusalem. So that was a relatively successful crusade in the sense that it brought more stability for the Christian kingdoms there. All right, the last crusading period, which, looking at my watch here, the fourth crusading period, 1202 to 1204, the whole point of crusading in this sense was to retake Jerusalem. And so that was their main focus. Richard had went back home. Richard now wants to go back. They want to go back. Pope Innocent III, again, there will not be a test on this later. Maybe I should. issued a new crusade to accomplish this. But, like his predecessors, he had to deal with Europe's kings fighting amongst each other. Unfortunately, Richard died in 1199, and so he never got to go. But the crusade was mainly saved by a couple individuals, one of which was a preacher and the other which was another count. And they basically made a deal with the Venetians to carry them over to the Holy Land. The Venetians said, here's what the payment's going to be. And they said, all right, we're going to make provisions for 33,000 men. Well, 33,000 men in the Middle Ages would have been an enormous army. Not even one-third showed up. So then it's like, well, now what do we do? Well, the Venetians said, well, we have this city that was under our control. They're not been very friendly to us. They kind of cut off. And they're under the protection of the Kingdom of Hungary. If you go over there and take them and give them our, basically, you can pillage and get some payment through there. If you get back the city, we'll give you transport. So the crusader said, okay. The Pope said, no, you will not. And anyway, it's a long, complicated story, but basically the Doge said, the Doge who's the ruler of the Venetians, basically said, nope, you got to pay. Well, you've been sitting here for 3 months in Venice. You got to go. And so the Pope's emissary said, no, you can't take the city. And so the Venetians basically said, okay, then you can go back to Rome. Goodbye. We're taking the crusaders with us. We're going to go take the city. They ended up taking the city. The Pope excommunicated the entire crusading army. And so they had to apologize later. The Doge did not receive forgiveness from the Pope. And he said, well, basically, they surmised that they knew the Pope would make him give back the city. So what his intention was to burn down the whole city and apologize for it later. That was actually what was going to happen. So that was his clever solution. Meanwhile, you have basically a prince from Byzantium who turns out to be a complete fraud. But he comes and says, hey, if you help me and get me back on the throne, because I've been unjustly treated by my family. And so they end up going there. Well, it turns out he wasn't a very, very popular person. They said, hey, look, we have your new king. They're like, oh, that guy? No. And so the crusaders ended up attacking Constantinople. I'm obviously shortcutting a lot of stuff here. So many of the rank and file people abandoned this crusade altogether. Alexius had previously petitioned the Pope for help and sent him away, and now was not happy that the entire crusade was on its way to Constantinople. And it's after this, and I'll read this to you, Constantinople would never really fully recover. This is from Madden's book. The sack of Constantinople ranks as one of the most profitable and shameful in history. Although a sack of a city that resisted capture was acceptable in the medieval moral code, it is clear that the crusaders did much more than just plunder. Despite their oaths and threat of excommunication, they ruthlessly and systematically violated Byzantium's holy sanctuaries, destroying, defiling, or stealing all they could lay their hands on. Many also dishonored their vows to leave the women of Byzantium unmolested. When Pope Innocent III heard of the conduct of his pilgrims, he was filled with shame. And he wrote to his legate, "For they who are supposed to serve Christ rather than themselves, who should have used their swords against the infidel, have bathed those swords in the blood of Christians. They have not spared religion, nor age, nor sex, and have committed adultery and fornication in public, exposing matrons and even nuns to the filthiness of their troops." One of the Byzantine senators who witnessed the events contrasted the sack of Constantinople with the fall of Jerusalem to Saladin, judging that Byzantium would have fared better if it had been conquered by the infidel. He lashed out at the crusaders who had sworn to deliver Jerusalem, promised to kill no Christians, and even proclaimed that they would refrain from sex until they arrived in the Holy Land. Quote, "In truth, they were exposed as frauds, seeking to avenge the Holy Sepulchre. They raged openly against Christ and sinned by overturning the cross. With the cross they bore on their backs, not even shuddering to trample on it for the sake of a little gold and silver. The Byzantines' deep sense of betrayal and bitter anger towards the Latins would become lasting legacies of 1204 that for many still live today." And Middle East crusading would continue, by the way, until roughly around 1302, but it was all but certain to be over in 1291 when Acre fell. So that was really the end of the crusading period in that area. All right, I have 3 minutes to give you my conclusions. Any questions about any of those? If you have questions about details, you can come up and see me afterward. But let me give you my basically, I've got 3 basic conclusions. Crusading, as I've described it here, and it's been described historically, is impossible for Protestants to adopt because it presupposes the authority of the Pope, it presupposes the unity of Christendom, and the spiritual benefits of indulgences. Christopher Tyerman, who is one of the sources that's listed on here, has said this as much. I'm not going to read this quote. He's got a lengthy quote that I have here. But he basically says this very thing, is that crusading in a modern sense is impossible. He also mentions what he calls the interiorization of the faith. Faith is not expressed this way publicly in the same way that it was then. So you cannot duplicate these conditions. This is the universal judgment of historians on this topic. However, I will say that as a masculine expression of Christianity, we don't need to denigrate the Crusaders in and of themselves. There are actions that can be and should be condemned, but very much the same way that we would not denigrate veterans of war today simply for being in the military, we don't have to denigrate them to simply disagree with the various conflicts that they fought in. I myself am a veteran, in retrospect, not very pleased with what we were doing during in the first Gulf War. But I hope that I'm not spit upon simply because I was there. Now, I know that there are some who would, but I don't think we have to do that. And I think the same is true for the Crusaders. We can admire their bravery. We can admire their courage. We can admire their motivations to some degree without excusing actual sin. Okay? The third thing I would say is that the Reconquista model, if we want to call it that, which is the retaking, without the meritorious, without all of the other excesses of the Roman Church, I think maybe a better motif for us to think about. And the reason I say that is because they were literally pushing out people of their land, and it took them, I mean, basically they didn't finish crusading there. They started in 722. They didn't finish until 1492. Okay? So it took them 700 years to finally push all of the Muslims out, which led, by the way, to a whole bunch of things, including the Spanish Inquisition. There was a bunch of other things. By the way, does anybody else know what happened in 1492? Yeah. Well, it's actually as a result of the end of the war is why it enabled them to say, we now need to go explore and build these new trade routes, which is a really interesting, fascinating piece. So it was the end of that period that enabled the exploration of the West. And so, again, this is ironically one of the few long-term successes of this period, besides, now, there were people Christianized. It's like talking about colonialism to some degree. There were good aspects of it, there were bad aspects of it. So we're not going to accept it or condemn it wholesale in the same way I think we should treat the Crusades the same way. Understand who they were, what they were doing, why they were doing, without giving them credit, positive credit, for everything that did happen at the time. All right. Wow. We just covered many, many years of history in a very, very brief time. And I don't know how effective it was, but any final questions or comments? Yes, sir.
During the 1,000 years, were the Jews so... What were the Jews doing? Were they playing double-sided?
No, actually. So on some of the crusading on the way to the East, the Jews did not suffer well because they said, well, if we're going after heretics in the Middle East, why not going after the heretics within our own countries? And so there were many pogroms against the Jews. The Jews did not fare very well. And the Pope actually spoke against it and said, this is not what we're doing. So that was what was going on. Now, the Jewish communities, I think, in the Middle East did not suffer the same kind of thing, but they were treated very much like the Muslims were. So they were, again, the Christians did actually what the Arabs had done earlier and kind of let them practice their own religion in places. That didn't become much more complicated, honestly, until the 20th century. And that's a whole other lesson, which we're not going to get into today. Anything else? Thank you for that, Brian. All right, if not, let's close in prayer, move into worship. Heavenly Father, these things we admit are very challenging for us to understand, dates and places and motivations and things that, as your people, we would not adopt and even condemn.